Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I think the public banking initiative that you're spearheading, Ellen, is the single most important thing I can think of. We both know that whoever controls money controls everything. And if somehow there was a beginning of an effort to establish public banks in different places, to any extent, I mean, you get a few established and it could be momentum for more, but that would be such an important objective to achieve.
Whoever controls money controls everything, says our guest Stephen Lendman, and we all know that to be true. It's that axiom and its unfortunate misappropriation of the golden rule, that is, whoever has the gold makes the rules, that has stimulated a number of recent events in the world of public banking and given rise to some celebration as well as new hope. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute and Ellen Brown's co-host here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Today we're going to take a look at how public banking is showing up in recent electoral politics and the momentum being created by these recent victories and pending prospects. From coast to coast, there's substantial forward motion on investigating and adopting a public bank solution for cities, counties, and states. We'll discuss the New Jersey gubernatorial victory of Phil Murphy, a former Goldman Sachs banker who ran on creating a public bank and won. We'll talk with one of the members of the new New Jersey legislature, Andrew Swicker, about how a legislator looks at the prospect of creating a new state institution for its money. And we'll talk with Amara Enya in Chicago about another promising new gubernatorial prospect that might be adopting it as well. And out west, the California Treasurer, John Chang, has concluded a year-long task force investigating public banking to potentially solve some major financial challenges, including whether such a bank could be helpful in managing the new and growing legal cannabis market. Ellen's guest today is getting to be a bit of a regular with us, thankfully, noted author and commentator Stephen Lendman, whose comments opened this program. Stephen sees the promise of public banks from the perspective of its democratic function and its power to protect public interest and assets. Let's check in with Ellen now about the developments underway around the country.
So, yeah, we've had quite an exciting week with Phil Murphy getting elected, and that same day that John Chang held a press conference in which he discussed doing a feasibility study for a state-owned bank the press conference was actually about cannabis and what to do with the cannabis money. They're getting, They're anticipating a $7 billion business starting in January when it's legal for everyone, not just medical, of which they anticipate $1 billion in taxes. So, of course, they want that tax money, so they're quite motivated, and they've got a federal problem, and therefore they're looking into whether they might be able to do a state bank to handle all that. But the big news is still Phil Murphy's. What do you have to say about that?
Well, there's so much to say, I wouldn't know where to start exactly. We have certainly arrived at some sort of a threshold into a new era of opportunity because the Murphy campaign and its success, and it was driven not just by a public bank, of course, but also I think that Murphy's a very progressive addressment of public need and his willingness to talk about issues from a commonsensical, popular perspective certainly carried him forward. It's a new day because, you know, we were all excited about his running on this platform, which, of course, in itself created a momentum around the country. Now that he is elected, or now that he is the governor-elect, the burden turns to the people and to him and to the administration to make something real out of it. And, of course, one of the things that has to be prioritized in a long list of state needs, many of which are totally unrelated to the idea of having a bank. So the idea of a public bank now needs to compete with the other issues that are on the table. And we will, as citizens in New Jersey, you know, our intention is to support Murphy and his intention, and also to help to shape it. Public administrators, executives, policymakers are all making it up based on what they think will work best and what they know. And in the case of public banking, what we see around the country is that people don't know much about it. Even at the highest levels of executive, municipal, government management, what's a public bank? As we know, and as has been demonstrated by our colleagues across the water over in England in Positive Money, most of the elected officials don't know where money comes from. So, you know, we're kind of taking the opportunity of democratic control of our assets right back down to a basic understanding of what does having a public bank mean. And so that's part of the process that we feel as the group Banking on New Jersey, as the citizens of New Jersey who are leading this fight, is to get people to, first of all, understand what it is, and then to start to understand how it relates to their own interests. So if you're a small business person, a student, or you're concerned about infrastructure or a host of other issues, how does public banking serve that? And that, I think, is where we're at now that Murphy has won. You know, we've been in touch. He was very gracious in acknowledging our help along the way, and we intend to partner with him. And I think, Ellen, that kind of partnership is what people should position themselves for to move public banking forward at municipal levels, county levels, and at state levels. We need to dig in with an understanding about what money is, where it comes from, and our ability to manipulate it and to create it with this new mechanism. I think that's really going to be the task, is to get the people to focus now on getting right down to the hard work of figuring out how to go forward.
Right. Oh, that's great.
And I must say, you know, you've mentioned cannabis in California, and it seems to me that the Treasurer Chung's meeting last week certainly indicated what a long shot it is to try to get any kind of a chartered bank institution to mitigate the federal constraint on depository banking. Frankly, I mean, I don't think that public banks are going to be in a position to help that situation until the feds act.
Yeah, well, that's been our position, that it's hard enough to get them to set up a public bank, which is something new and different and unknown, and to also make it a something different from the Bank of North Dakota model, which is already proven, and to do something that's federally illegal seems to be sort of a stretch. But if they can pull it off, I mean, I've always thought that where there's the political will, you can do remarkable things. I mean, look what Roosevelt did. He said, well, this banking system isn't working. We're going to go off the gold standard. And I don't remember, somebody important said, we didn't know you could do that. You can do anything if you've made up your mind that that's the way you want to go and you can get your people to follow along. But money itself is just, you know, a social construct.
Yeah.
So we can reconstruct it. In fact, that's what I'm writing about as we speak in a book on the coming revolution in banking, how we could restructure the whole thing to make it fair and equitable and democratic.
Which means, I suppose, that money then would no longer be a vestige of the most powerful, of the power centers, but it would be a utility of the distributed power of the people.
Right.
At least, you know, to put a phrase on it, but that's an uphill battle, for sure. I think one of the things that we shouldn't overlook about the public bank prospect on the cannabis issue is that because it's going to open up this massive new market of revenue generated from the local economy and enabling the local economy, having a public bank, even if at least initially is unable to accept deposit because of the chartering and the federal regulations, I think we all know that is going to change over time. But having a public bank as an institution allows the state to incentivize using that bank as the depository for the cannabis proceeds. And I think that's important because it keeps that money, it could potentially keep that money out of the big banks, which are hungry as anybody to get that those dollars. In other words, you can incentivize depositing your money as a cannabis distributor by using the public bank and then help to keep that money local, and also then, of course, provide the liquidity to the public bank that will help it to lend further into the community.
Yeah, it seems to me that, or this is what we've even said in our little PBIC group, Public Banking Initiative of California, for a state bank, that the most viable way to approach it is to set up a sort of a model bank on the North Dakota model, just to demonstrate that you make more money funneling your money through your own bank than funneling it through Wall Street, to show how much money you can save and how you can stimulate your local economy. Yeah. And then when that works, then you can branch out to take cannabis deposits, et cetera. And in fact, of course, in many states, there aren't local banks, or not to speak of, not a, well, for example, we have a Welsh group that's moving right along on a public bank, and they don't have local banks. So they're not even talking about partnering with local banks. They have to come up with something different. And here in Santa Barbara area, they don't have much in the way of local banks. You may not be partnering with the local banks anyway, because you may not have local banks. So you may have to come up with some other structure.
It doesn't it seem, though, that because so many states have infrastructure banks, understanding that these are revolving funds and not real banks, doesn't it seem that that's kind of like the lowest fruit, the most available mechanism that exists that could be turned into a depository where they can leverage, do that leveraging sort of capital?
Well, I would think so. If they're buying municipal bonds, I mean, that's just real easy. Pay 1% and make 3%. I mean, that looks like a no-brainer. And you can't go wrong with municipal bonds. I mean, very, very rarely does a municipal government go bankrupt. We've had a couple, but those are, you know, big news makers. But if you're talking about making loans directly to contractors, now that is risky. So that's probably not what you want to do. You know what I mean? Because they can go bankrupt.
In that instance, it seems to me the public bank then would be lending only to agencies of government.
Yes, and that would be a very safe way to go, particularly just to prove the model.
Yeah.
Then if you want to help the students, I think that you can make loans to students and for housing, et cetera, just like any bank does. They do proper underwriting standards to make sure that they've got good borrowers here. And then they set the interest rate to cover what they anticipate to be the default rate. And that's the way banking works. There's no reason that our state bank can't do the same thing, even for things that are considered somewhat risky.
And it's really funny. It's not funny. It's actually kind of depressingly tragic. We are now so misinformed about what money is and where it comes from that we can't even see how we're trapped by the people who are creating it at the private banking levels.
And it seems to me, I mean, I just went to that cryptocurrency conference in Aspen, and all the Bitcoin cryptocurrency people all see money as a thing that you dig out of the ground, and that's why they've tried to duplicate that with Bitcoin and all those 1,200 knockoffs. I mean, they're not all Bitcoin knockoffs, but there are 1,200 cryptocurrencies now. So it's a very popular up-and-coming thing. But they're thinking to replace the national currency with something that's like gold. But gold is not what our money system is, and gold has never worked. It didn't work, you know, in the Middle Ages when there was not enough gold to go around. That's when they started writing out these receipts that became banknotes, expanding the money supply with fake fractional reserve notes that weren't really backed by anything. And that's what they had to do in order to expand the money supply sufficiently to run an economy. So really what our money is more like a community currency system where it's pluses and minuses, keeping track of who owes what to whom. And without, you know, a thing that you have to acquire from somebody else and hoard it or pay interest on it. I mean, not that interest serves its own purposes. I'm not saying that we necessarily need to do away with interest, although it's possible. I can see a way that it could be done. But anyway, we're looking at money wrong. And so even people who are think they're reforming the system, it seems to me, are going backwards instead of forwards. The people that are going forwards at the moment are largely in the third world because they don't have this old infrastructure that they have to knock down first. So they're just going straight for the thing, which would be in India, for example. They have this really cool thing called India Stack, which I won't try to go into, but it, basically they're turning their own credit into money through their cell phones. Yeah. And in Africa, they have M-Pesa, which is a payment system through the cell phones. And now, you know, Russia and China and a number of countries are talking about issuing a digital currency. So basically, it'll be a central bank currency issued digitally instead of having to get your money from a bank that creates it and pretends it was always there. The government itself can issue the money.
Mm-hmm. Well, money continues to be the determining denominator of what's possible. Well, Ellen, thanks for that update, and we'll check in with you shortly and hear what you have to say with Stephen. Sounds like we've now got a new guy at the Fed, which may be more old news, but look forward to hearing that.
Okay. Great talking to you.
Good talking to you, Ellen. Thanks.
Congratulations on your great success in New Jersey.
With nothing.
The New Jersey team.
Thanks.
So, in talking about the prospect that New Jersey might lead the nation in employing a state bank, we thought it would be interesting to see how this prospect looks from a legislator's perspective. The idea of a state-owned bank is very new and, as mentioned, not necessarily well understood. Will it actually appear on the New Jersey legislative agenda on the new governor-elect's calendar? What obstacles might we expect in the process of bringing the state bank idea forward, and what should the people be doing to encourage bringing that prospect forward? One recently re-elected New Jersey legislator, Andrew Zwicker, a Democrat from New Jersey's 16th Assembly District in the Princeton area, is a plasma physicist at Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, and he likes to be referred to as an evidence-based decision maker. What evidence does he see that might encourage state bank legislation?
It's something that's building steam in New Jersey because of Governor-elect Murphy's speaking about it. So it is, you know, it's kind of interesting. You're talking about debt. You know, the first thing when I'm out knocking on doors, anyone wants to talk about is their taxes and just the cost of living. So there's layers before you get to, well, how are we going to approach this? How are we going to attack this? The idea, when people get to the idea behind a public bank, for the most part, they go, oh, that makes a lot of sense, and they're very supportive. But it's clear also that, you know, this is a big, bold idea, and, you know, it needs the momentum that the governor-elect has put behind it. Both for, you know, whether it's for the legislature or for the, you know, the people of New Jersey to really get behind it and to understand, you know, what this can do and, you know, what it can't do.
So there's an educational phase here that's going to have to take place to create more buy-in?
Absolutely, right? You know, it is something that will take a lot of education. And, you know, it's education of people on the street, it's education of the legislature, administration, you know, a lot of people. Since there's only one state that has this, a lot of people don't know about it. And so I think while getting the structure of a public bank in New Jersey just right is obviously critically important, so is getting the people of New Jersey to understand what it can do and why they should want to support something like this.
There are many fiscal issues confronting the state. For what you know, do you see that this has a prospect to address resolving some of these?
I think it does. I mean, there's a part of the public bank that, because of my background as a scientist, and this idea of, you know, well, how will a public bank invest back into New Jersey, I find particularly intriguing. And that is investing genuinely in ways that will create jobs, spur the economy. You know, a public bank of New Jersey for New Jersey now has the mandate to do just that. So, you know, I talk a lot about an innovation economy, which is something that is high on the list of Governor-elect Murphy as well, you know, and driving small and medium businesses who are focused on innovation as job creators. And so, you know, having a New Jersey public bank that is going to potentially invest in these sort of things, I think is, you know, very exciting because it can lead directly to job growth. And right now we are underinvesting dramatically in our innovation economy, yet we are one of the states that has got everything in place in principle to be an innovative leader. So I look at my science side and what a public bank has the potential to do as a really exciting step forward. I am encouraged that the activism that we've seen in New Jersey around the country is only going to build up momentum. I think those two things is how we have a movement that starts to change politics in the United States. So there I'm optimistic. Building that political momentum and that education is going to be just so critical because the pushback is going to come from more than just the banking association,
right.
You know, and you know this better than me, and you got to gear up for that.
That's Andrew Zwicker, the newly reelected assemblyman from New Jersey's 16th Assembly District. So with Governor-elect Murphy's win in New Jersey, does that mean that the topic of public banking can be a winning campaign platform? We heard Ellen talk earlier about the California governor candidates getting increasingly close to adopting a public bank platform for their races next year. And now we're hearing of another couple gubernatorial prospects as well. One of them may be in Illinois, a state not unlike New Jersey in that it's facing some significant financial shortfalls and high debt. The public banking movement in Illinois and Chicago has been quiet in recent years, despite some legislative initiatives that would spur the banking agenda forward. Now it may be returning to the political arena through a candidate with a remarkable political pedigree, Chris Kennedy. I spoke with a public policy advisor and former candidate herself for Chicago mayor, Dr. Amara Enya. Amara is also a community activist and has been leading efforts to support systemic policy changes that can bend civic outcomes toward more justice and economic fairness. She's teamed up now with the Kennedy campaign and says that while the decision to incorporate a public bank agenda has not been made yet, the environment for progressive policy improvements characterizes the Kennedy agenda.
Chris Kennedy, he's been involved in civic life in the state of Illinois for decades. He is the son of the late Robert F. Kennedy and the nephew of John F. Kennedy. He has been behind or involved in several civic engagement issues and advocacy for years. He also has a very strong anti-status quo message that it is all about transformative change. He also is very strong on the issues that his father and his uncle cared about, these issues of fairness, of justice, of equality. I think it creates an opportunity for some of the transformative policies that have been locked out. I think his candidacy and his campaign unlocks that door, and it creates a pathway to the implementation of the policies that we know can be transformative.
And public banking, of course, is being one of those. Tell me, about 2 years ago, Amara, you testified in Springfield at the State House for a bill for a public bank. And a public bank has been on that agenda in Chicago and in Illinois for a couple of years. Where does that movement stand?
Yes. So we've definitely been working on this issue for a couple of years now. That didn't stop us, however, from still pushing this issue at the local level. So back in 2016, I authored a chapter in the book, Chicago Isn't Broke, Funding the City We Deserve, and my chapter focused on the public bank and making the case. We, once the book was completed, went on a tour essentially around the city. We did more than 50 public presentations to community groups and organizations on all of these recommendations, transformative recommendations, with the public bank being one of them, and educating the public on this. And so we did that for a couple of years. So while in Springfield, there was sort of this things had ground to a halt, we still made sure that we were doing the advocacy and sharing this information and building support and awareness of this as a viable mechanism to really turn the state around and in Chicago, turn the city of Chicago around. This election cycle, this just presents an opportunity for us to pick up where we left off with this legislation, and I can't think of a better opportunity to do this than now.
What are the primary economic issues that the state is facing? And do you think that addressing the public bank opportunity through the state level is more likely than trying to do it through, let's say, the city level in Chicago?
Well, the issues with the state and the city of Chicago are similar. The state, I would say the biggest issue is the structural deficit. Even though we have a budget that was passed, we still have pension obligations that need to be met. And the state still has not figured out how to sustainably address our pension obligations. That's mirrored at the city level. So in the city of Chicago, we also are operating at a deficit, but we have pension obligations that are going to balloon in a couple of years. And the city still has not identified any source of revenue to make sure that we can meet our pension obligations. And obviously, all of this is mandated by state law. We also have the revenue question. Where is the revenue coming from? So that gets to all of the primary functions of a public bank, particularly in helping to spur economic development. That's the big question that has not been resolved at the city level or at the state level, and that is where the opportunity exists. I also think, just from an operational standpoint, when it comes to infrastructure, Illinois is behind in really making sure that our infrastructure as a state is up to date, is upgraded, and that's statewide. And so when you think about the potential function of a public bank and being able to mitigate some of the costs with infrastructure, cost overruns that we would be paying to traditional financial institutions, that could be a huge, huge advantage. That's also the issue in the city of Chicago, where we've got to make sure that our water systems are upgraded, our roads, our public transportation, all of that, and what we pay in interest and overage and fees just to traditional financial institutions could be significant if it were actually recirculated back into our economy. So you're seeing a lot of mirroring issues at the city level and at the state level. And I think the opportunity that I see is we should push simultaneously. I think it's supremely helpful to push this legislation at the state level because the state needs it. But I also think that it's helpful to push this at the city level. As a home rule city, the city of Chicago could also do this. And so it's not an either or, it's a both and, because the need exists at both levels. One of the things that came out of the more than 50 community-based events that we did was just the feedback that we were getting from people about the idea. First of all, it became very clear that there's a real curiosity. People are looking for solutions. They're looking for alternatives that we can build that address the issues that we face. And so I can talk all day about the state's $15 billion of unpaid bills, or the fact that the state owes $250 billion in pensions to state workers when they retire. But there's always that question of, okay, what do we do about it? And there is a vast curiosity in just the public space about that next step. What do we do about it? And so whenever we talk about the public bank, you can just see people's eyes widen. I mean, you're shifting the paradigm for what they think about banks and financial institutions, which is this notion that a financial institution could actually work for the public, that its only allegiance is to the public. And so that gets them excited. You see people tapping into what I call their civic imagination. They're starting to think more creatively about, okay, this, we can actually do this. How do we build this? How could this look in our context? And so the inquiries are still coming in, people sending emails. We want to learn more about a public bank. We want to learn more about this. Where has this worked? Why don't we have this already? And so you see that excitement. Yeah, a lot of people are just saying, well, it makes complete sense. What are we waiting for? And so I think that's why we're in a time where we can really tap into the curiosity, tap into the enthusiasm, and tap into the fact that people are not, they're not paralyzed by this notion of the status quo. They actually feel like, okay, well, we should have done this a long time ago. Let's do it.
That's Dr. Amara Enya discussing the possibility that public banking may find its way into the Illinois gubernatorial horizon for next year's election. Now, here's Ellen with our guest, Stephen Lendman.
So on November 2nd, Donald Trump nominated a new head of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell. And Stephen Lendman has written an article on that. Stephen is a prolific writer and syndicated columnist who hosted a radio show on this network, the Progressive Radio News Hour, for many years until he had to stop due to health issues. But he hasn't stopped writing. He's just grinding them out like crazy. So he wrote an article recently on Jerome Powell. So, Stephen, it's great to be talking to you once again.
Ellen, it's always great to be on with you. We have marvelous discussions. Yeah, I had a talk about the new nominated Fed chairman, and it doesn't happen very often, and it did just days ago. So I believe in February it will be official. Powell will take over the reins of the Fed after Senate confirmation, which is virtually rubber stamp. He wouldn't be nominated if he couldn't be selected, approved by the Senate.
Right, and I have done a little research, and he looks pretty acceptable to everyone. I mean, he's moderate. He's a Republican. I guess he was the first. Obama appointed him as a Republican, which was very unusual. Normally, he was a Federal Reserve governor. He has been for the last 5 years, so he's got that experience. He was he's the richest man on the Federal Reserve board, worth $112 million. And he's not an academic like the previous several Fed heads. So that I'm sure that appealed to our president, who is all about business. So he's a businessman rather than an academic. Though I saw that he was editor-in-chief of the Law Review at Princeton Law School. So it's not like he's a good writer. I mean, I saw one speech that he wrote about Fannie and Freddie, and he's actually so he looks like acceptable, you know, acceptable all around. So I'm sure you're right that he'll get approved.
Oh, indeed. And I think it's important to point out that presidents don't pick Fed chairman or Fed governors. They simply make the announcements. Wall Street makes these choices. Why? Because the Fed is owned and controlled by Wall Street, and it wouldn't tolerate anybody who wasn't one of their people in charge of the money that they control. So it's pretty automatic. And as far as approval by the Senate, rubber stamp, Ellen, we know that.
Yeah, agreed. So it doesn't look like things will change much. He goes along with Janet Yellen's moderate approach to reversing all these radical measures they took, which I think is a mistake. I think they actually shouldn't be raising interest rates, and they shouldn't be selling back those bonds, because what it will do is drive up taxes. I mean, raising interest rates is going to hurt small businesses, for example, that have long-term loans out there, or housing. I know that you've also written and have thoughts about Trump's tax plan, so that works in with our debt ceiling issues.
I guess on the one hand, Ellen, it's hard to see interest rates around the 1% level instead of close to the 0% level that will do much harm. And the fact that the stock market keeps going up, it doesn't seem to be too excited or annoyed or disturbed by the fact that there were rises in interest rates, a number of them. Apparently, there'll be another one that's already baked in the cake for December. And I don't know what that will put rates at, 1.25%, maybe heading for 1.5%. I mean, my God, I can remember when I thought 5% was low.
Yeah, well, but that's the rate at which banks borrow from each other. So it has already driven student loan rates up. And my concern would be the federal debt, because already we're at some... If they keep raising rates to where they were talking about, which was, I think, 3.5%, then the interest on the debt will be something like $800 billion, which would pretty much soak up our personal income taxes. So I think that's actually why they pushed it so low in the first place, was to allow the government to go hugely into debt. You know, they doubled the debt just since Obama was elected.
Well, they certainly did, and a great deal of that. So many elements went into raising the debt. I guess back in 2008, early 2009, bailing out the bankers and the enormous amount of money that's spent on militarism and wars. And we just learned in the last day or two or three that the amount is threefold the official amount. Something like $5.5 or $6 trillion waging wars against countries threatening nobody, but we still keep waging them. And I talk about black budgets, Ellen. When I talk about the defense expenditures, I talk about you can't just look at the Defense Authorization Act, the act that gets passed every year, allocating $600 odd billion to defense. I mean, that's not even half of what's spent. It's something like $1.5 trillion spent on everything related to what's called defense, which isn't defense at all. It's offense, not defense. So the Defense Department really should be called the U.S. Department of Offense or the War Department, which was the name of it back in World War II, Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the War Department was the name before it was changed to the Defense Department. That would be a very appropriate term for me.
Right.
Calling it the Department of Offense is a little bit awkward, but calling it the Department of Defense is absolutely false. It's got nothing to do with defense. America doesn't have any enemies except its invented ones. Goodness, I write about this all the time. As far as economics and finance, Ellen, well, you know, it's all about taking care of the big boys and sticking it to everybody else.
Yeah. Catherine Austin Fitz has worked with these numbers a lot, and she has discovered or found or reports that there are $40 trillion in missing money, black budget money, and $21 trillion they've now documented of undocumented adjustments, which means things for which they don't have any receipts for. I mean, they haven't said what they were. They were just adjustments. And so the undocumented adjustments annually are actually larger than the actual budgeted documented adjustments, you know, documented receipts or whatever. In other words, they're siphoning money off all the time, and where is it going? So when people say to me, what do you think? Is the market going to crash? Are we going to have, you know, is the dollar going to collapse, etc.? There's no telling, because it's totally, everything's manipulated. If they want it to crash, it will crash. If they want to prop it up, they will prop it up, and they've got the means to do it.
Well, I absolutely agree with that, Ellen, and that's exactly what happened during the 2008 financial crisis. I think it was manipulated. I remember a wonderful article you wrote about Lehman Brothers. You know, was it pushed? You're darn right it was pushed. It was a great time for the street to consolidate faster at cheap prices. I mean, to gobble up these firms, it's a lot better gobble for them. You know, the Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and the rest of them, it's a lot better for them to gobble them up at fire sale prices rather than full market value. So, they made out like bandits. Well, they are bandits, and they made out like the bandits they are, gobbling up the remnants of these firms. You know, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns. Oh, I can remember Bear Stearns stock toppling for, I forget what it was exactly. It might have been as high as 200. I may be wrong on that, but that number sticks in my mind, somewhere around that. And it just toppled to a tiny fraction of its valuation just a couple of months earlier. So it was easy pickings for the predators to gobble this stuff up, and Lehman and others.
Right.
Merrill Lynch, maybe the biggest name of all.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan Chase bought up Bear Stearns, supposedly bailed out Bear Stearns, but in fact, J.P. Morgan Chase got the asset, and they got it. They did it through a loan that they got from the government. So,
The way it always works, Ellen. In my small business career, we discovered that the banks were very eager to lend us money if we needed it, at a time we did not need it. But at we needed it, they didn't want to talk to us.
Right. Well, I've also just written about how all these regulations, starting with the Patriot Act, which is probably the worst in terms of stressing the small banks, they've all had the effect of driving the small banks to sell out to the big banks. So the big banks are just getting larger and larger. This whole thing about too big to fail, the Dodd-Frank Act has made the big banks too big to fail, partly because that was the intent that with the bail-ins, although it was very, at first, nobody understood that. You know, I argued that after Cyprus went down, and people would say, no, that's not what it's about. And I mean, I got a lot of pushback from that at first. I think maybe I was one of the first people to write about that, they were actually bailing in. The plan, what it says in the Dodd-Frank Act, is that a too-big-to-fail bank that becomes insolvent is required to. They actually have a legal mandate to take their creditors' money and turn it into capital of the bank. In other words, take the money. And the largest class of creditor of any bank is its depositors. So that was their plan all along, not to get rid of these too-big-to-fail banks, not to downsize them, but to actually make sure they were too big to fail.
Oh, indeed. So, I mean, the bigger they are, the more likely they are to fail. I mean, we will bail them out by one means or other. And I do remember the crisis, the Cyprus crisis, and I wrote about it too. And a tiny nation literally pillaged, and legislation, I believe. It's been so long since I wrote about it, I don't remember it exactly, but legislation that could be pending in other Western countries, America, European countries, where, as you say, they literally could take our money to bail out these financial institutions they want to save. Not the ones they don't want to save, but the ones that they do want to save. So that stuff is coming. I think there'll be another crisis at some point or other. And if the big banks need helping, well, ordinary people like us will be the ones that will pay the price to benefit them.
Right, and they've intentionally made these regulations so stringent that the small banks get hit with 1,000 pages of regulations, and they need to hire extra people to do it. I mean, some small banks only have a handful of employees to start with, so there's no way they can compete with the big banks, so they virtually have to sell out to the big banks, and there is reason to believe that was the intent. I mean, I've quoted different people who said so.
Well, there were so many small banks that went under or sold out or whatever in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. There are many fewer of them operating today than there were then, and probably more will disappear in the future. We might end up with a couple of three or four or five major banks running financial things entirely, Ellen, plus what the insurers do. And are there any independent investment bankers around? Of course, Goldman Sachs is running the Trump administration's economic and financial policy.
Yeah.
So it really is. The U.S. Treasury Department is really the Goldman Sachs Treasury Department.
Right, and that's where the $40 trillion are buried, somewhere in there.
Good Lord, I have no idea about numbers like that. I mean, the debt is astronomical, and the money spent is obscene. And if we get a tax cut anything close to what Trump wants and Republicans want, then we'll see more escalation in the debt. And I mean, it's just hideous, Ellen. As far as the tax cut goes, I mean, if it passes, it would be a giveaway to big corporations, not to small business so much, just big corporations, and to super rich people, and maybe middle income people would get a tiny bit more in 2008, and much less as you go into the out years. And at the end of a decade, they may end up paying increased taxes, not getting a tax break. And there'll be people anyway who will get a tax increase by the plan. It could change drastically before anything becomes law, if it even does. David Stockman, former budget director for the Reagan administration, it's been a few months now, he said he didn't think anything would be enacted into law. I haven't seen what he's saying recently.
On the one hand, it's quite discouraging that the people obviously have no voice in what the government does. I mean, we think we do. We elect people that we think are going to do or that have policies that we agree with, and then they don't do them. But I think maybe the one good of it is that people have gotten so disillusioned with the whole political process that they're realizing they can't just rely on electing the right guy or the right woman. They have to do something more creative. They have to take matters in their own hands. Of course, that's what we've got lots of action now on the public banking front, where we hope to be able to save the community banks by following the Bank of North Dakota model, where the state bank would partner with the local banks, help them with capital, help with liquidity, and help with the regulations.
I think the public banking initiative that you're spearheading, Ellen, is the single most important thing I can think of. We both know that whoever controls money controls everything. And if somehow there was a beginning of an effort to establish public banks in different places, to any extent, I mean, you get a few established, and it could be momentum for more. And I'm certain I'll never live to see the day that anything really major will come about. But that would be such an important objective to achieve. And I certainly agree, and I've written so much about the fraudulent U.S. electoral system. I mean, voting in America is literally a waste of time. You simply get the same old, every election. Republicans and Democrats really aren't much different from each other. They talk differently, but when it comes to policy making on the major issues, they're really in lockstep. And by that I mean war and peace and corporate empowerment and so much of the horrible legislation that they pass, even though they one speaks out of one side of their mouths and the other speaks out of the other side of their mouths. But when you wrap it all together or put it all together, they're really very much the same. They would never, never vote to end U.S. wars or be fair to American consumers and not just be one-sided, the big business and the rich in America. But they certainly talk a line entirely different from that.
Uh-huh. And you do get the sense, I mean, I've listened to politicians that I liked and they sounded like they meant well, et cetera. It seems to me it's the system. I mean, they're sort of trapped into, first of all, they have to cater to big money to run their campaigns, and then they have to make promises, I suppose, and go through with their promises, or who knows what sort of pressures are applied. I've always thought that once you get to be president, they take you into a little room and they show you a picture of the Kennedy assassination, run the video.
Oh, there's no question about that. I don't have his exact quote, but Vladimir Putin explained the way America's system works very, very well. And basically he said something like, when a new president enters office in America, men in dark black suits, like the one I'm wearing, I remember he said that, show up at the White House with briefcases, and they explain the facts of life to the new president. This is the way things have been done. This is the way you will do it. And everybody goes along. And as you say, the lesson of Jack Kennedy is pointed out to anyone who may be a doubter or a non-believer. And I mean, we can see what happened. I remember vividly the promises Obama made before he was elected, and more recently, the promises Trump made before he was elected. And the policies of both of them, a polar opposite everything they promised on all the big stuff.
Yeah, I know. It's really very disappointing. But I suppose it's to be anticipated. Yeah.
It's why I call voting a waste of time, Ellen. It really is, because ordinary people have no say whatever on how the country is run. And all you have to do is look back over the history of the country, and that is very, very evident from its origination. Back in 1776. It was that way then, and it's even worse today. Because way back then, Ellen, black people weren't people. They were commodities, and women didn't get the right to vote until around 1920. They were considered only homemakers and child rearers. What kind of a democracy is that?
Well, I'm sort of a one-trick pony. You know, I just keep writing on this one thing, public banking. We need our own banks, hopefully. In hopes of changing this one little thing, and maybe they'll have some effect.
Well, again, I don't know.
You definitely cover the field out there. You write. You're so prolific. You write so many articles per day.
Well, what you're doing, I've written about public banking too. I haven't done it in quite a long time now, a number of years. Earlier, I wrote a number of articles on public banking and the Bank of North Dakota and so on. And your book, Web of Debt, absolutely inspired so much of what I've written about. I did a massive review of your book, and I quoted it often in future articles.
Too.
I mean, it's such a remarkable book that I can't imagine. I mean, everybody should read that book. And they would know the way the system works in America, and your follow-up book. Those two books on public banking and what it's all about, I mean, that would really be an eye-opener for most people who don't understand the way America's financial system works.
Well, I think that is how, thank you for saying that, I think that is how they get away with so much, is that people don't understand that the government does not issue our money. Banks create our money, and they have control over who gets it, on what terms. So they basically control the money spigots. And what I'm writing about now is a different way of doing it, where we can eliminate the middlemen. So the system itself isn't bad. I mean, the fact that really the bank is turning your own credit into money. Like if you wrote an IOU to your grocer, he wouldn't take it. But the bank will take your IOU and turn it into checks, which are actually the bank's IOU. So they're basically guaranteeing your IOU after figuring out who you are, where they can find you, how they're going to get the money if you don't pay up. And of course, they'll charge you interest for that. So that system is not all that bad, that you basically have a third-party validation of your credit, and that's what money is, spending credit into the economy. But what's wrong with it is that we've given these big private banks the power to control who gets to turn their credit into money, what the terms are, where the profits go, where they get invested. So if the banks were made public, then we could recapture control of all that, put the money, turn the profits back into the economy where they need to go in order to create the demand necessary to buy the products that the people make. In other words, otherwise you've got money being, what you have today is money being siphoned out of the system into money-making money schemes, which are just growing like this parasite on the side of the economy without actually contributing goods and services, or, you know, without contributing work. What you really need is a system that where money is not a thing in itself, but it's merely an accounting system for keeping track of who has done what and who owes what to whom.
Oh, indeed. I mean, it really is a fascinating topic, and it's obscured even in school. And I don't know how they teach money in banking today, but for me, back in the 1950s, I was a marketing major in my MBA program. But everybody had to take a mandatory course in money and banking. And I remember that course. I disliked it so much. And looking back, I understood better why I disliked it so much, because they really didn't explain anything to me about the way America's system works, except a lot of formulas that I had to either commit to memory or know enough about to be able to discuss when questions came up on an exam. But there was nothing about the control of the Fed by Wall Street, And all of the things that you write about, Ellen, and what I've written about. I mean, all of that was simply omitted. So what the devil did the money and banking course teach me? It really ended up teaching me nothing. Maybe to believe that the system is a good system, and don't worry about it, it's in good hands. The people controlling it know what they're doing. Yeah, they sure do for themselves, but not for ordinary Americans.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that courses like that do is you feel like, well, I understand all that. And so then you don't go back and revisit it. So you feel like somebody understands it, you get it. It's the bank is just taking in money and lending it out again. And, of course, they're taking some risk, and then they have to borrow whatever. But you understand the George Bailey model of banking, and you figure that's what it is. So it's very hard to, once you've had that programmed into you in school, it's very hard to break out of that mindset and see it a different way. I think that's partly why people like me who come along from the outside can maybe see it more objectively, or, you know, see it more quickly than, well, for example, my son has a degree in economics, and, you know, he used to argue with me all the time. No, that's not the way it is. I mean, he would give me the conventional line. But I think everybody's coming around now that the Bank of England has acknowledged that banks actually create our money system, and the Bundesbank confirmed it. So we've got a lot of official acknowledgement now.
Well, it certainly is the case, and I would love to know the way the business schools teach this subject today. Again, my day was, over half a century ago, and whether things have changed and the subject matter is taught any differently than it was back then, I simply don't know.
Well, I know you have another big interview coming up. That sounds a bit exciting. They're actually coming to your home with cameras.
I'm hoping that what they're interviewing me on will be a topic that they're particularly interested in, because Russia-U.S. relations are so dismal. And I wrote an article this morning asking, is U.S. war on Russia inevitable? And it really feels like things are heading in that direction. And I know that they're very concerned about things like this, and with the action taken against RT America, forcing it to register as a foreign agent. Of course, it's not a foreign agent, and the act went back to 1938, enacted to counter Nazi propaganda ahead of World War II. And the idea of equating RT with something like that, I wrote about action against RT a few times. In the article that I wrote this morning, I wrote about it again. RT registered on Monday as a foreign agent under the Foreign Affairs Regulations Act. I compared RT doing that to what the Nazis did to Jews in the 1930s and 1940s, forcing them to wear yellow stars, identifying them as Jews, and Jewish businesses forcing them to ID themselves in a similar fashion. So making RT register as a foreign agent, when it's not that at all, it's a media operation. It's really the same thing to me. And we know what happened to the Jews in Germany and in Europe. And I fear the next step against RT is shutting it down altogether.
Yeah, it is rather alarming what's happening to free speech. But I think it's because free speech is breaking out all over. I mean, they can't really seem to stop the internet. And so they're sort of desperately flailing around trying to keep us all channeled through the mass media, which we're not doing. I mean, I'm sure you don't watch TV either, but I don't even know how to work my TV. It's too complicated.
I basically do the same thing. The only time I turn on a television set is when I'm eating, and it's usually to turn on RT. I glance at the other media, Ellen, because I do a lot of media critiques, and I want to see where they're going. But after about 30 seconds of it, I can't stand anymore, so I have to tune it out.
Well, I know you're sort of in a hurry. Do you want to tell people your website and how to find
your
work?
Yes, I have a website. I had a blog for many years, and for the last 4 or 5 months, I have a website, and it's my name, Stephen Lendman, Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, StephenLendman.org, and I post new articles on it daily on all sorts of topics.
Okay, great talking to you. I've been speaking with Stephen Lendman, a writer and formerly a syndicated columnist who also formerly had a radio show on this network, Progressive Radio News.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.